life's gone down the drain. Your body's wrecked with pain. There's just one thing to blame. Dynamite in the brain.
Broadcasting from the Mayhem Moon, it's Dynamite in the Brain with your host Brian Smith and special guest Bradley Meek.
Hello.
Hello, Bradley. Today's episode is sponsored by pomegranates. Need to illustrate the concept of renewal in one easy fruit? Try pomegranate, the choice for millennia. Pomegranate can also aid in the cessation of the urge to devour children. Why this talk of pomegranates? It's because we are here to talk the 2013 Toei TV anime, Kyosugiga, directed by Rie Matsumoto, is an expansion of a single 2011 OVA and five subsequent 2012 webisodes. And if you want to watch it, you can currently find it on Crunchyroll or in physical form as a Blu-ray-DVD combo pack from Discotech. And this is what Crunchyroll say. In a mirror city that is Kyoto, and yet not Kyoto, where humans, monsters, and robots all live, 14-year-old Koto searches for her mother. She encounters a monk named Mioe, who is waiting for his father to return. Family and the mirror city itself are at stake as this action fantasy unfolds. So, Bradley, are you returning to the mirror city, or is this the first time you're visiting?
I'm returning. I watched it as it aired years ago. And it still feels very fresh to me coming back to it. I think in part because if I haven't seen something in 7 years, I've basically forgotten it. But I did kind of like tear up just listening to the opening again for the first time in a while. Cause this is a series that, kind of still hits me in the heart. You know, it's a really good family drama that also has a lot of terrific animation.
It is, yeah. I had watched the OVA, which I loved, in 2011. The webisodes, I couldn't remember what my feeling was about them. I did have a look at them. I think I liked some of them more than others. Mm-hmm. And then when I went back to look at these after I watched the TV series today, this week rather, I was like, oh, I was surprised like at just how much of that material is in there. But the TV show, though, I think when I watched it originally, I hit that break week where they went on a trip around Kyoto, two of the actors, and I'm not sure I came back to it immediately. I don't know when I'd finished watching it the first time around. And I have to say, watching it again this time, I'm like, I do think the material in the OVA, and which makes up a good deal of those first five episodes, is better than the final five episodes of the series. But as you say, it still looks great. It's the most surprising thing rewatching it in terms of visuals was how much the CG elements don't look old.
Yeah.
They're
blended in very, very well.
Yeah, and I think it's because of the visual style the 2D element has got means that it's got that, I don't want to say super flat, but it's definitely what it reminds you of if you were familiar with it from the first half of the first decade of the 21st century.
Well, there's another word I haven't heard in 7 years.
I know.
But you're right. Yeah, it definitely has that look. Jeez. But it feels like its own style, right? It doesn't feel like it's derivative of much of anything, even though it is clearly influenced by a lot of things.
That's
from
it, yeah.
Classical Japanese art, all the way up to like maybe something like Superflat or just anime's general love of mixing a kind of modern and ancient aesthetic with a lot of like high concept technology kind of inserted in.
Yeah, there's. I mean, the other thing gives me the feeling of, particularly when the ending theme kicks in, is of Fooly Cooly.
Yeah,
to a degree, a little bit of the giant robo OVAs, particularly in the episode with the giant robot. But I don't know how much of that is directly influenced by the anime or because it is so. This is the thing I was worried about. After rewatching it, I was like, oh, I may have bitten off more I could chew, so I better do this thing at the start of the episode. So I was like, oh man, there's an awful lot of Buddhism here. And I don't know much about, but you can write it on the back of a cigarette packet, what I know about Buddhism, or possibly write it in the script of a 10-episode anime series. I don't know.
Expertise in a podcast is optional.
It is, yeah. but I was like, am I supposed to know this to get everything, or is it supposed to be introducing me to various concepts? But then when they start throwing in little bits of other mythologies, I was like, or is it just a lot of these things are universal and it doesn't matter that it's drawing on a lot of Buddhist imagery.
Yeah, I think the Buddhist elements are just one of many, many elements that it's drawing from, including, I think there's a lot of Greek mythology in here, really.
With the pomegranate stuff, I was like, oh, I know that from Greek mythology. So then I looked up pomegranates in Japan, and I was like, I got a list of, here's all the mythologies around the world which have pomegranates, and they all kind of involve renewal in one way or the other.
Really?
Yes.
And all of them, like, concurrently in their own ancient societies were all thinking of pomegranates as tied to the underworld.
I think from Japan, obviously, it's the import of Buddhism, which we get. There's like a little nod to that when we see the trailer for the giant robot, where it's what those statues from the previous culture in Japan of this Buddhist robot beating up a monster which looks like one of those statues. Which, of course, there's a robot which looks like one of those statues in Giant Robo as well, which is another reason the very first fight in the OVA. So yeah, it's the import of ideas and how they get changed as they it's the Jungian collective subconscious, again, which I'm a dilettante in everything I know, so I know as much about that as I've read in the Oxford World Mythology Dictionary that I used to have, and I've just ordered a new copy after watching this week, because I realized I threw the old one out because I'd worn it out through using it as ideas for role-playing game campaigns. And I shall get a new copy and then create similarly bad campaigns off the base of it. but that basically treats like all myth is, its approach is like it's the comparative mythology thing of like, when you look at a lot of myths and folklore around the world, there's an awful lot of similarities. So do they all have a common source, or does human nature make these things spring up? Regardless of where humanity is in the world.
In Kyosogiga, I think its answer is, oh, it's actually all a common source. See, there is a shrine that rules the cosmos and watches over the 12 planes, but God has depression, so one day he decided to make a family.
Yes, but that is not revealed until the second half of the series. So the 12 worlds, that's a Buddhist thing as well. Yeah.
Okay.
The 12, again, I don't want to talk about it too much because I'm ignorant, so all I'd be doing is reading Wikipedia pages. I'm sure you can find people who know more about this, who've written about this already on the internet. Just type in Buddhism Kyosugiga into Google. I'm sure you'll get something. Yeah, the second result, something called a blog called dancelikemonkeys.wordpress.com. That's monkeys as spelt in the 60s band. Kiyosugiga Analysis, Alice, Buddhism, and Idealism. Oh, yes, of course, there's an awful lot of Alice in Wonderland.
Alice in Wonderland as well, yeah, yeah.
And the 12th, 13th century sequential art, Choju Jinbutsu Giga, Animal Person Caricatures, which I was like, okay, maybe there was more. Because when we went to, me and Niall went to the British Museum manga exhibit in 2019, and they used both an Alice in Wonderland motif and the animals from Choju Jinbutsu Giga to guide you round. And I was joking, it's just because they had a load of Alice in Wonderland material left over from a previous exhibit about Alice in Wonderland. But I guess maybe there might be a bit more to it than I was giving them credit for.
I do feel like Alice in Wonderland is one of those Western stories that has really permeated Japanese pop culture in a way that a lot of others really haven't. I don't know if that's a Disney thing or if it's that the original story has kind of established itself as like as something that kids just end up getting through osmosis. Like video games really probably is the real answer.
Yeah, there is an anime adaptation of it. Well, there's multiple.
Like a World Masterpiece Theater adaptation?
I think similar to. Don't think it was part of it, but there's the dub of it is on the UK Amazon Prime. There's a whole bunch of. I don't know whether it's in the American one as well. I guess I could check on Just Watch. It's I don't know if it's Nippon Animation. It's in a similar style to that wonderful Wizard of Oz that had the Sinar dub. That Discotheque have got the distribution for the Japanese version. Don't know if they've got the dub one or not, but I know they were putting episodes of that up on YouTube for a while. And then there's definitely been more recent. What if we did an edgy take on Alice in Wonderland? Because I assume at some point it had got into the public domain, and so therefore everybody was free to do their edgy takes on Alice in Wonderland.
It's always the first thing people try too, right? Even though I think Alice in Wonderland is kind of a dark story in its own right, so.
Yes. Whereas this doesn't feel like a take on Alice in Wonderland, it just likes to make a reference. It alludes to it a lot, obviously, with the idea of this being a mirror city, and I think they're just straight up making quotes about it towards the end.
Yeah, Inari quotes from it, doesn't he, with the life is but a dream poem.
Yeah, is he doing it, or is it the secret agent shrine scientist doing it? I can't remember.
I think Inari does at one point when he is in the, I don't remember the actual term for this, but I'll reference another English classic, The Secret Garden, where his wife was kept, and they had returned to that. So this is when they're kind of talking about what Inari had decided to do near the end of the anime. And he does an extensive quotation. I think it's from Alice in Wonderland, but I may be wrong about that source. I could Google that right now.
Hmm.
But why would you look up things for a podcast?
Exactly. So the story beyond what Crunchyroll tell you is we're sort of thrown in with this 14-year-old girl who arrives in this strange world carrying a giant hammer and accompanied by her two brothers, A-un-un, the beginning and the end, who are both like middle school aged boys and also weird ghosts.
Weird ghost who will sometimes make themselves look like middle school boys.
Yes. And she's got a teacher who is also her father, called Inari, who looks almost the same age as her and wears a fox mask. and the work for a organization called the Shrine, which is led by the High Priest, and there's a few other characters who get a bit of time at the start of the series, and then kind of fade into the background somewhat. And then meanwhile, we also get a story happening in the past about a troublesome priest who is asked, I can't remember, is he asked to leave and then the rabbit falls in love with him, or does the rabbit fall in love with him and then he's asked to leave? I can't remember which order.
Yeah, I think he was the soul hermit in a temple. I don't know if he was forced to be a hermit or if he chose to be.
Yeah.
But he has a strange power that he's able to like make drawings come to life, and people view that as very frightening.
Yeah, there's like a bunch of talking heads of other spiritual types, and then we see a council basically asking him to deciding that he needs to leave town. So he's drawn a rabbit. The rabbit has fallen in love with him, and then the rabbit's love is noticed by a Buddha who offers their powers to the rabbit in order to...
Not just their powers, I think also their body.
Yeah, yeah. To get his love. And they sort of... Early on in the series, we learn that they have a son called Yakushimaru. And then after they've had this son, they then get the son, an older brother and an older sister, which are also drawings that have come to life. One is a Buddha and one is an Oni. But it becomes hinted at through the first half of the series that there's more going on with the son than initially meets the eye. And then we learn in the present day, the world, that Koto, and also Koto, the girl, has the same name as the rabbit, that the three children now rule this town, and we see that the parents had to leave the town, the shadow world, because she was only supposed to keep the body until he'd fallen in love with her. And the longer she stays in the body, the more risk it puts to the mirror world that she's having this dream predicting that an apocalypse is going to come. And so the parents leave the mirror world to the children, and that fucks them up in various ways. The older brother wants the parents to come back so that he can leave and go to the real world. The older sister misses her mother so much that she can't let go of the past and is basically hoarding every single thing that reminds her of her mother. And Yashikumaru, we learn, wants to die, essentially, because he can't die because of his father bringing him back to life earlier in the story. And as the story goes on, you certainly learn like how they're connected to the characters from the Shrine and the characters in the family and the characters in the mirror world. And
they're connected to Koto too, right?
Yes.
In those episodes, they don't really know who Koto is. They suspect she's tied to her parents, to their parents somehow. Yeah. But interestingly, they all see different aspects of their parents in her, depending on kind of what they want from their parents returning, right?
Yes.
Like, for instance, Yase sees a lot of her mother in Koto, and Mione sees a lot of his dad in Koto. Kuruma's probably the most ambiguous, I guess, in what he sees in Koto beyond maybe finally an end to this long wait.
Yeah, he sees that he's interested in her, in what her powers are and what they mean to, because in the world of the mirror world, nothing can die, nothing can be destroyed, but now she showed up and her hammer actually lets things to be permanently destroyed. And so it starts off, It starts off with a very science fiction explanation of things in the first half of the story, and then it becomes more spiritual in the second half. Particularly once lich people start going, oh yeah, I'm a god. He's a god. Our dad's a god.
You're a god. Did you know you're a god? You're basically a god.
Yeah. because in the first half, it kind of follows almost the format of those webisodes, where it focuses particularly on one character at a time. So the first episode is very much like looking at the parents, how they got to the mirror world. Then we get Koto in the second episode with her arrival in this world. So you know you've got an outsider here. And we get to the background of the shrine in that one. And then you start getting the next three are like, okay, what do each of the children want? Kurama is like, while he's behaving like a buddy, he's got this team of scientists. He's trying to find this way to get the parents back, because that will open the, once the door's open for them to come back, he can go out himself.
Because he feels some obligation to stay in the Mirror City, because even though the children basically rule the city together as a council of three, he is effectively the one in charge.
Yes.
Because he's kind of the most mature, and he feels like if he leaves, then it would just be children running everything. even though in his own way, he hasn't really grown up either, right? One of the striking things about those early episodes is how, like, the kids are older, but they're still children, especially Yase.
Yes. And they comment at the end, towards the end, that what they're actually doing is waiting for Yakushimaru to grow up, because he's the one who's supposed to be in charge. Because he's the real boy, as opposed to just being drawings. And then after we get to that halfway point, and then the actors take a trip around Kyoto for a week, then it starts getting into like what is actually going on. You've had like the clues with Yakushimaru. It's like, okay, he's clearly not the actual son of Koto and Miyue, because we keep on getting flashbacks of him killing himself. And at the end of episode 5, he decides to work with Koto to find his mother with the promise that, or tries to get Koto to promise, but as she points out in episode 6, she didn't promise anything, that Koto will kill him once they found his mother, who is possibly Koto's mother as well. And then we get like a, we also get a scene. There's like his father had told him that he'd return with the beginning and the end. And then when he learns what At and Un's names mean, he's like, okay, that's somehow connected. But we also see he's taken on the name or role of his father, but it looks like his father has literally put his DNA into him, even though he's not his blood relative. It looks like as he was leaving, we just see like a cartoon DNA strand come out of his hand and go into Yakushimaru, and that's why now Yakushimaru as an adult looks like his father, even though his father's not a blood relative.
And he also left him his prayer beads.
Yes.
Before disappearing, which turns out to be significant later.
It does, because he was supposed to be in charge. They give him the power of creation. It's episode 7, or episode 6, they get Mum back as well, after they test Koto's powers by having her fight the giant robot. Then Mue comes back and we discover it is Inari. Then the shrine show up in episode 8, the world comes to an end in episode 9, and then in episode 10... God shows up, and we've had the full explanation at this point of like, okay, the high priest is God's son, and also so is Mue. The high priest was responsible enough, so he was the one left in charge of the universe, but Mue was like, well, I've got this power of creation, and yet you don't want me to do anything with it. So that's what he ends up drawing these pictures, creating people, creating this shadow Kyoto, or mirror Kyoto. And so they have to beat Dad up until he comes to his senses. Both the children and Granddad take turns beating him up. This is overly simplifying things, but that's essentially, and yeah, then they're a happy family by the end.
And I see where you're coming from with the last five episodes not working as well as the first five or the OVAs. I think it's very easy to feel things get bogged down once it keeps expanding the scope until it gets to the biggest scope it possibly can at the cosmic level, right?
Yes.
And trying to follow the thread of what is really going on, like, takes work. And I kind of had to constantly ask myself, wait, what is going on? How does this connect back to some of the stuff we've seen earlier? And that doesn't really allow me to emotionally connect to the characters in the same way, even though there's still elements in each of these episodes where just their kindness to each other, especially as everything goes really, really bad, connects with me in a way that a grand cosmic story, like, it's irrelevant to me whether the scale of the story they're talking about is, well, we're just keeping this in this secret mirror universe of Kyoto that looks cool, versus this story actually affects all of reality, you know.
Yeah, the other thing is like, oh, will the mirror world be destroyed? Can they keep it safe? I think the one thing which I think the other damaging part, and I normally like him in a lot of other roles, it's Kazuki Yao as the High Priest, and it feels like weirdly miscast because I'm constantly thinking that's Kazuki Yao. And why isn't he?
Oh, and he seems a little villainous?
Well, not villainous, but he's like, his voice is more interesting than the character, but his voice is never really the one, because he needs to be like both kind and threatening at the same time. And yet I keep on just wanting him to burst into Frankie or Mr. Two. give me that, let that voice come out and go to its full heights. Whereas I'm like, I know that voice when he first shows up.
I didn't realize that was Frankie, and now I can't unhear it in my head.
Because when he showed up early in the series, I was like, I know that voice, but it's doing a voice that I don't normally. Oh, it's doing a performance. I know the voice, but it's doing a type of performance that I don't normally associate with that voice. And it was somehow weirder than whatever the 80s show we watched last year, where he's the hero of an 80s mecha show, which was also a little weird. But this felt even weirder because it was like the genial uncle, who is, yeah, but it also has to be threatening and kind at the same time at the end. But yeah, you're right. It's the fact that everyone's still being kind to each other, even when they're turning into villains, or at least in the position of villains towards the end.
Yeah. Well, it feels less like they're villainous and more like, well, you made a mistake.
Yes.
You know? And this is families doing what family should do and coming together and kind of forgiving each other, you know?
It is. It was especially weird watching this week because of watching both WandaVision this week and reading My Hero Academia over the past couple of weeks. Of like, there's elements of there's bits of this in both of them. Obviously, the WandaVision's got the I'm going to create my own reality, and if you don't like it, tough luck. And people on the outside saying, or monitoring it, going, what are they doing in there? We've got to send in spies to find out what they're doing in there. And then also the idea of this terribly messed up family going, well, let's have another child and see if this one will fix everything.
Oh, no.
Because essentially that's kind of what they do here with Koto. It's like, well, we had these children in the mirror world. If we have a child in the outside world, we'll train her up and get her to fix it.
Because he talks about how they didn't really mean to have a child. And I was actually thinking probably too much about this. I was thinking, well, if Kodo is the product of a god and a Buddha, that probably wasn't like a biological creation, right?
No, I don't think. I don't think
probably some cosmic logic that's closer to like Athena being born from Zeus's head. Here.
Yes, yeah. I don't think they had them to fix everything in the same way that I don't.
Yeah,
that's not entirely. But just the most recent chapter of My Hero Academia, as we're recording, is the Todoroki family discussing. The terrible mess they've made, and their conclusion is that Shoto, he'll pull us all together, he'll get it all sorted out. And then the final panel is two other heroes on the outside of this hospital room. Oh, I don't know if they're supposed to look like their eyes are rolling, but that's what it looked like to me. Oh, mainly because that's what my eyes were doing as I was reading that chapter.
I think a lot of anime, because it's, let's be honest, primarily targeted at like teenagers and children or adults who still have kind of a teenage appetite for media, right? It has a very cynical view of adults and parents most of the time.
Yeah.
And I think this is a much more mature story about parents screwing up to the degree that they do. Again, it just has... It's a story with a very open heart.
It does, but it still has that very anime thing of people confronting an argument by slapping each other in the face.
It has that too, yes. Your dad needed to be headbutted really hard to understand that he screwed up.
My sister needs to be punched in the kidneys. I need to be punched in the kidneys. Everybody needs to be punched in the kidneys.
Well, it is a cartoon at the end of the day.
That is true, yes. I'm gonna whack my brother's giant robot over the head with a giant mallet.
Its cartoonishness is one of my favorite things about it too. It has that cartoony style, the way things move, the way things are exaggerated. Objects can kind of, like, even a building can bounce up and down when Koto uses her giant hammer to hit the street. It's got good cartoon logic and physics throughout.
Yeah, and it's got the the makeup of the people who live in the city are, say, like, all over the place. It's humans, monsters, yeah, but they're all kind of living in peace, apart from that one naughty, naughty imp who throws away Yasei's.
And never got caught either. Cup.
No, that's the other thing.
He didn't learn
thing.
Anything from that.
No, he was just very pretty when he saw all the plates and cups flying into the sky, but he wanted to find some more. Yeah, it's the visually, I think, is the thing which attracted me, and it's still the thing which mainly attracts me now. Though I'm tempted to watch this more often, so maybe it will reveal a bit more of itself on more frequent repeat viewings.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I wouldn't mind watching this again, and I do feel like I would notice things I had missed before. Definitely the second half can be so dense with things just happening, not really being explained until later, and you have to remember what they're referencing to feel like you're still following the story.
Yeah. Yeah, that is for sure. Trying to think anything else particularly of note about the production.
I want to talk about Rei Kugimiya,
yes,
who does the voice for Koto. And I think Rei Kugimiya, I think because of her role in Hayate the Combat Butler as Nagi, I think she gets pigeonholed into a lot of quote-unquote tsundere roles. Here, Koto is, it's a very cute voice, but it's a different kind of character. This is like someone who is kind and optimistic, but also very cute, and also kind of a scoundrel in her own way, kind of a brat. I really enjoy the character Koto, not just because she has a giant hammer and smashes everything with it, and that's a lot of goofy fun, but I think Rei's voice is a terrific match for the character. It's a great performance.
It is, and yes, apart from Yael's, and I think Yael's still doing a decent job, it just feels a little bit miscast. I do like all the voices through here. I just noticed because this was 2013, wasn't it? I'm just wondering whether her first appearance as Sugar in One Piece was around the same time, and that's going to mess my head up with how long ago that was. August 18th to 2013 was...
Oh my gosh. I was in a Discord chat recently where someone said something to the effect of, oh, I like to watch old anime classics like Spice and Wolf and Toradora, and I just crumbled into dust and died. I've reached that point in anime fandom now. Yeah. Where it's like, no, that's not... No, children, stop.
When was anime for Spice and Wolf? That was
like 2011, I
think? 2008. The first series.
2008, okay.
So it's not quite there yet on my metric of 15 years being the point at which you can say that's now retro anime. 10 years isn't long enough to say it's a classic. 15 years, I feel like 15 years is a good metric, because you look at stuff from 15 years ago and there's stuff you go, okay, I watched that, but that has completely left my mind because it wasn't a classic, and other things you go, okay, I can still remember all the details of that.
Yeah. It was. Well, I think it's also 15 years makes sense to me because anime is primarily like a teenager thing, right? So it makes sense to me that something that would have aired when a 16 or 17 or 18 year old was like a child way too young to kind of watch any of this.
Yeah.
Should be called retro.
Yes. Yeah. That sounds about right.
Yeah.
It was mainly like, I was like, I wish I'd left this more time to delve deeper into the Buddhism thing. But the other thing I was fascinated by is the co-writing credit it has with Izumi Todo, which was a entirely fictional person Toei have to give creation credits on things that's in-house. Similar to the Hajime Yatate's The Sunrise one. And apparently they have one for a separate one for the Tokusatsu and some other stuff. And I was like, because they're credited on most of the Pretty Cures, if not all of them. But I was looking at like, oh, but they're also on a lot of the stuff that's Toei original like this. Because I was like, okay, where did this fall in the line of Toei original stuff? So you've got Shinzo, that's the US name for that. Musha Rambo, I think it was originally called. I don't know what his connection is. There's a movie version of it from Kenji Nakamura, which I think is just a compilation of the show. But I have never seen the show itself. It is genetically altered creatures known as Entarans take over the Earth and rename it in their own images Entera. It was on Jetix and ABC Family in the States. And on Fox Kids over here. Then they had Pippo Papo Patrol Kun, which I think there's a fan subber group doing that at the moment, which is a kids show, I think, about a police car. Or maybe I'm thinking, no, I think there may be a separate show about a police car that's being fan-subbed. Oh, no, it's Pippo Papo Patrol Kun. Okay. There's Tomorrow's Nadia, which I have seen a decent chunk of. Have you seen that, Bradley?
No, I don't think I have.
It feels like a show designed for parents who watched Nadia Secret of Blue Water when they were kids to have something slightly similar to show their kids. I think it has some Hosoda work on it, if I remember correctly. It's a British girl joins the circus to go in search of her parents' story. Mm. And while Nadja's Secret of Blue Water had one lion cub, this has two.
It's, dang, so it must be twice as good.
Twice as good, yes. Gin-iro no olenesis, which is a thing I had not heard of until today, which is it had a light novel made of it. Plot takes place in a fictional future in the year 3567. During this time, a supernatural barrier called the Olenesis Barrier, which disrupts time and space, envelops all of the Earth. This is mind-boggling that this is a 2006 anime that I have never heard of till today.
What was it called again?
It doesn't have an English name, I don't think. Let me just see if there is an English name on the Anime News Network. Or maybe it's listed as a French name. Olenesis the Silver Colour. Ooh, maybe I have heard of that. But I don't... No, maybe not. It does not ring a bell at all. It has not had an English release. Has anyone ever fansubbed it? That's the question. Is this just like a really weird... Okay, there's a fansub of the first episode for 2013. The show came out in 2006.
That's interesting. If someone 6 years later was still like, well, people need to see this.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. Or they dug up an old one and reposted it. Master Hamsters. I do know this one because I know this was on the Toei Europe website as please license this show. It's about a bunch of hamsters doing jobs.
Okay, yeah. Hamsters doing jobs is funny.
They are special hamsters who pass the examination to obtain the badge, which allows them to transform into Meister Hamsters. So I guess they're also magical girls. With the ability to speak human languages. They secretly take part in various jobs and help people, although no one but their own keepers know it.
Oh, so they're secret master hamsters.
Yes.
Hmm.
Yeah. There's one appears to be a fireman, one's a doctor, one's a chef, one's got a big old hammer, and one looks like he's a race car driver. But his race car appears to just be a scooter. Marion Galley, that one I have watched a chunk of. That's the shorts about a young girl called Mary and Galileo. It is something tidy.
Oh, yeah, I've seen a little bit of that.
Yeah. I say visually, it's I think it's the closest to Kiyosu Giga in terms of its flat, cartoony style. Then we had Kiyosu Giga after that, and then something called a film called Pop in Q, which again.
Pop in Q?
Pop in Q. A Japanese animated dance film. A crowdfunding campaign for a sequel novella was launched 2 years ago.
How'd that go?
It reached the goal in 24 hours. A crowdfunding goal for the second novella was December the 7th, and it was reached on January the 25th this year.
I'm looking at these posters. I like the look of this anime.
That's what I was thinking as well on the poster. I was like, that looks like an interesting poster. And again, I don't know how much of these are all magical girl adjacent. Because that's the thing we can talk about at Kiyosu Giga, is it is kind of magical girl adjacent. Yeah. Obviously, the background with the director coming off the Pretty Cure stuff before this. But they do say magical girl at least once in the show.
Yeah, and her character type is very much a magical girl character type, right?
Yes.
A kind of optimistic, kind girl who also has super magical powers and is a little mischievous.
It is. I mean, I would like to see a Pretty Cure where the enemies are the way you were brought up by your parents. I don't think they'll go quite near that knuckle at any point. Yeah, that would be a little bit too much of anarchy. Yeah, and I guess that yeah, I'm saying anarchy is definitely the feeling you get early in the series with Koto. And yeah, then that has to be, that energy has to be channeled. And yeah, that's the other thing with her and her brother, is that they, I guess they're also the beginning and the end by the end of it.
Yeah.
He's got the creation powers, she's got the destruction powers. Put them together, what have you got? God!
More or less.
Yeah. So it's worth going through those list of things, because it did trigger a few more things I wanted to talk about in that. I'm curious about seeing Shinzo at some point. More likely the film, because it's Kenshi Nakamura. I'm curious to just find this Olenesis, just to find out what it is and fill a hole in my knowledge. And this popping cue. It seems weird that it's not come up. There are fan subs for that. Also, it's a dance anime, which I guess is... There are a few of those, but...
Yeah. I've seen some. Like, I years ago, I watched one that was focused on the clappers, I think is what they're called. That are used in like a traditional Japanese dance.
Yeah. Actually, there's loads when you think about it, isn't there? Because there's the Tribe Called Crew, the It's spiritual sequel, whose name escapes me now. Mm-hmm. There's that Hoolering Babies about Hula.
Kamen Rider had dance as a sub-theme in one season.
It did, yes. That season.
With the anime writer guy writing that season?
Yep, mm-hmm. yep. I did not watch that. I started watching it, and then I was like, it's
too... Oh, you never watched? Yeah, that actually might not be a bad choice. I'm not sure how I feel about that season of Kamen Rider at the end of the day.
I was like, oh, it's definitely Urobuchi. It's like, these characters are all just like, this is my philosophical point of view, and that is my entire character, and I'm just going to state my philosophical point of view over and over again in the face of your philosophical point of view. Which is why I've not even bothered with Thunderbolt Fantasy, no matter how much otherwise that might be exactly my sort of thing. the one time I've tolerated him was his single episode of Concrete Revolutio, where it kind of fits straight in, and it was only one episode, and it was about Wolverine, essentially, in Vietnam, superheroes in Vietnam. Anything else to add before
really
we
need to go back and watch Concrete Revolutio? Every time we talk about it, I think, that really does sound like something I'd enjoy.
First season is absolutely fantastic, and the second season is not. But you'll, in a way that you won't be annoyed at the episodes you get. You'll just be annoyed at, clearly they didn't get as much time or as many episodes as they needed.
It's like an interesting failure then.
It is. You watch it and you're like, okay, well, these episodes are a lot more rushed than the first 13 episodes were. And there's only 11 of them. And by the time you get to the end of the series, you're like, there was at least one more episode we should have got that we didn't get. And the finale probably could have done with another episode as well. If you like your tokusatsu and your history of tokusatsu, and you like your left wing politics, and you like your you like to be feel incredibly doomed about the world,
that sounds like me.
Concrete Revolution is definitely for you.
Oh
yeah. See, if you like to feel doomed about the left wing's inability to form a cohesive stance against anything, then yeah, Concrete Revolution is definitely for you.
Jeez. On cheerier topics, you want to talk about Rei Matsumoto for a little bit?
Yeah.
Though I don't know how much I have to say about her, because I'm not I know that she established herself as a really good director through Pretty Cure.
Yes.
But I haven't seen a lot of what she's done outside of maybe some Pretty Cure and Kyosu Gaiga.
Well, I've seen Blood Blockade Battlefront, which is essentially the only thing that she has done apart from those two music videos after this. Apparently a couple of episodes of Saint Seiya Omega as well. Yeah, but Blood Blockade Battlefront is the first season of the Blood Blockade Battlefront adaptation. And it's partially original stories, presumably from herself. Because once she's gone in the second series, there's no more original stories. Though it is a different writer, but I do wonder whether the original stories came from her. And it makes a good partner with this, in that it too involves a city where men and monsters live side by side, but they don't live side by side in such a peaceful manner. Essentially, it is about a organization called Libra in a town called Hell Salem's Lot, which used to be known as New York City.
That is terrific. Hell Salem's Lot. That's what we're going to call New York City in the near future.
Because a portal to other dimensions opened up, and now the city is full of people. I guess it has to be New York, because that it's like the idea of like what city would the residents decide to stay behind when it's invaded by monsters? I think that's probably why they picked New York City.
It's the Gotham City logic of, yeah, like, the only reason people stay here is because it's just way too cool not to.
Yeah. And then, yeah, it's about this kid who was given the eyes of the gods, and in return, I'm trying to remember correctly, in return, his sister has lost her sight, and so he's come to New York to try and get all this sorted out. But turns out his eyes are very useful in the organization dealing with monsters. Particularly the ones which are the problem are the vampires. But I will say, the original story they put into that first series, it's not so good as the stories out of the actual comic. In my opinion. I know other opinions are available, because I know people really do like it. But the second season, when it's just stuff out the comic, it just works so much better. The problem with the original material is it suddenly changes the pace that the story has otherwise. Because the actual comic is very episodic. It's like an 80s TV show, almost, where there's no real continuation of plot. There's continuation of character. You might learn new bits about a character, but it's not like there's a ongoing story which is going to have a resolution, because the series ended and then he restarted it with a brand new comic. I don't know whether that has more of a through line, but it is very episodic, and when it's dealing with these two new original characters in that first series, it just slows down so much when it deals with them. It does have the three old men from Cowboy Bebop show up in it, though. I think as young men, if I remember correctly. Because I think it's drawing the illusions with... Oh, there's a specific reference, and I can't remember because I noticed it so long ago. I think it's the episode with the kid who hasn't aged when during the gate accident in Cowboy Bebop. I think it's that episode that it specifically references. So, for Cowboy Bebop fans, do watch Blood Blockade Battlefront. It's still a good show. It's just not as good as the comic, and I don't think it's as good as the second season, which is... what's the second one called? Blood Blockade Battlefront and Beyond, which had a different director that had Shigehito Takayanagi. But after that, she did two music videos that people loved. The Baby I Love You Die Days and the Pokemon Special music video Gotcha from last year that people were all about. And probably more eyes on both of those videos than any of the TV anime she's done.
Yeah, probably. You think she'll go back to TV anime, or...?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know anything about her. I don't know any interviews from
much
her.
Much to speculate, I guess, yeah.
Yeah,
Kind of browsing her credits, she looks like a very hands-on director, because she is credited for just about everything in these TV series.
Yeah, that's that Bump of Chicken Gotcha video for Pokemon currently has 34,834,000 views.
Wow.
And I'm sure by the time I get this episode up, it'll probably have even more. I'll have one extra as I'm watching it right now. And I have to say, that music video is probably better than any of her TV stuff as well. It is a really good music video. and her TV stuff's great, but that music video, there's something to be said about a really good animated music video.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that I don't think anyone really ever achieves with a live action music video. I feel like you can get across a lot more different ideas within like a 3-minute time slot in animation than you can in live action, probably just through sheer practicality that you don't want to take up so much people's time. Real actors, as opposed to, because again, music video, you don't have to worry about any voice actors or anything either. It's just purely the animator's time, and that time comes incredibly cheap. He said cynically.
Yep.
Yeah, it's like I'm not holding any hope at this point. It's a bit like holding the same hope for a new Kenji Nakamura series. Another similar Toei talent who had his chance to make a load of series, and then apparently he no longer gets those chances to make those series. I realised it was Gatchaman Crowd's the second season of that, Insight. That was the last time when they appeared to let him make whatever he wanted.
Mm.
Though you'd think 34 million views on a music video might get you the chance to make whatever you want.
Yeah, who knows? Maybe she's working on something right now and it just hasn't been announced.
Yeah.
So. And I also imagine all of the people who have worked with Toei for so long, maybe they're still doing work that we just don't know about.
Yeah, that is true.
On other series.
That is true, though nowadays it does seem I can't move on a Sunday afternoon for people retweeting animators talking about their cuts on One Piece that week. Here's the animatic of this sword fight. I'm just looking what else. Okay, now that's a different Reiya Matsumoto. That's not the one I'm looking for. That's the one I'm looking for. The one who's still alive. Anything on the Wikipedia about upcoming things? No, because it's Japan, I would guess. Less likely to have rumours about upcoming work. Righty-ho, I think that is every bit of juice we can get off the meat of Kiyosugiga. Highly recommend it if you've never seen it.
Yep.
It is on Crunchyroll. Easy enough to watch.
Very quick watch too. It's 10 episodes.
Yeah,
there are like Brian mentioned, like two special live action episodes, which has the voice actresses touring Kyoto, plus a recap episode, which I actually found kind of helpful for understanding what the heck happened here. So.
It is, yeah, and that also plays into my bit of like, is it really that good, well written in the second half? If it needed an episode,
yeah, because then once they actually say what's going on, it's less complicated than it
yeah.
seems.
I just didn't
explain it.
Even on the second watch, because I think this is only the second time I watched it beyond the bits we used out of the OVAs. I was surprised like how clear it is from the narrator of like how all these characters are related. It's talking about a family and it's showing you all the characters in the picture. And it's like, okay, I guess they're all related, even the dog somehow. That's suddenly reminded my favorite like mean-spirited comedy bit in it with the older brother trying to work out the motivation of Hatchie the dog. About, well, if he really wanted to wait for his master to return, he could have done it in a different way than just standing outside and dying. So what I propose is that he wanted to die like that.
Yes. that bit is a lot. I want to end it on a positive note because, again, like, it's a terrific anime. It's an anime about a family that has a lot of problems, but they choose to be kind to each other at the end of the day, and that's what kind of hit me at an emotional core, you know? It's great stuff.
Good, good, good. We'll be back, hopefully later in the month, with another The Anime That Didn't Make Us, but who knows, in these plague-ridden days, might be hard to get older people. Otherwise, we'll be back sometime later in the year with Bradley to do some Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood, I believe, was the plan.
Oh, really?
Yes, mm. I'm fully okay once we've wrapped up Samurai Champloo on the recording this month, so I need another show to split into multiple pieces and force me to watch. Because I think I just need to get over that hurdle of the bits I've seen from the original adaptation, and then I'll... I'll be full blown into it again, I think, because
the what are basically recap episodes. It's a bizarre start.
But you got to do it because the old one is so different in so many ways. But that's a discussion for a future podcast. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Your life's gone down the drain. Your body's wrecked with pain. There's just one thing to blame. Dynamite in the brain. Dynamite in the brain. Dynamite in the brain. Dynamite in the brain. Dynamite in the brain.